If modern minds were consulted, many would say, we have seen something of what you relate. In the visions of the inn night, when deep sleep cometh upon men, many a sensitive soul would say, I have seen beautiful landscapes. These visions come and depart suddenly. Sometimes, indeed, they are nothing but the play of a fertile ideality, but in most instances they are real glimpses of scenes in the summer land. True, you might imagine a tree to be where there is no tree, but your ideality obtained its first lesson from seeing a tree which was real. One man may be able to imagine in his dreams just what another man cannot imagine without first seeing. So that the one man would have an actual objective experience, and the other only an ideal subjective experience. And it is philosophical that there should first be an object outside to impress the surfaces of the mind with the correct notion of its existence. Certain constituted minds go into the superior state in the natural slumber of the night, and never during their ordinary and waking condition. Never, during the day, can such minds be quiet enough. But at night, when all is very still, then the sensitive mind and soul for the first time have an opportunity to realize a sort of independence of material surroundings. Then the person's spirit rises up from beneath and attains to a finer state of thought and feeling. This higher conception of spirit life comes through a vision. But when morning comes, and the business of the world is resumed, the dream may not remain to cheer the weary heart. But if the same person should enter a corresponding state, even if it be after the lapse of weeks or months, the mind will instantly revert to and go on with the corresponding previous experience. The long time which may have elapsed between the two experiences does not break the chain. To the spirit, years seem like fleeting moments, for spirit, you will remember, lives in deeds, not years, in feelings, not in figures on a dial. The spirit realizes no time between an experience of 2 years ago and a corresponding experience of last night or today. Once I stood, while in the clairvoyant state, by the overwhelmed brain of a large man in an apoplectic fit. I examined him both physically and spiritually. I watched by his bedside until he recovered from the apoplexy. Being in clairvoyance, I saw the working of his spirit, and could easily understand the state of his mind. He had, in the midst of his sufferings, a clear and truthful vision of the summer land. When he recovered from the fit and came out of the state, he knew nothing of what had happened. And I too, at that time, when I came out of the magnetic state, did not recollect what I had seen. I remember everything now, in the clairvoyant state. Subsequently, I examined him a second time. He was then in a deep coma. I plainly saw what he was seeing, and might have felt what he was feeling. His mind was connecting the experience of 6 months previous with his present vision. He saw his heart's own happy companion, the loved wife who had gone before him, coming to welcome his spirit up the shining way. B saw the beauty of her coming, and I saw the beauty of her coming. The doctor put his ear down to the sick man's mouth to catch his whisperings. A joyful thought tried to gain utterance through his paralyzed physical organs. He wanted to tell his vision. But in a few moments he passed into the world of spirit. Before he went he did not realize the 6 months which had intervened between his first and second vision of the silvery rivers and the scenes of immortal beauty. A traveler may suddenly turn a corner in a new road and see a house and bridge before him, a few trees, a stream pouring through the grassy meadow and some farmhouses in the distance, and, though the road and the country are really new to him, somehow the whole scene is familiar to his eyes. He knows that he never saw it with his physical eyes before, and yet he is not surprised. He is surprised only when he realizes that he was never in that region before. Now I find that the picture of that scene was perfectly transferred to the sensitive canvas of his faculties while his body was in a deep sleep in the nighttime. While in your superior state, your spirit takes on its impressions of distant objects and scenery. This experience has misled many into the hypothesis of pre-existence. So the life of the spirit is natural. Your spirit does not realize any difference in feeling, whether you are dreaming or in a state of wakefulness. You travel about in the sleep state just the same as though you were awakened in open day. You visit people, you go into houses, you cross rivers, or take a long voyage, just as satisfactorily as though you had your physical body around you. Now this experience arises from a projection of your consciousness into the open world about you. This will explain the wondrous phenomena of the whole interior life. It may not explain the private double consciousness of some persons. One mind may see a real tree, another mind may imagine a tree to be where no tree is, but the latter is a subject of impression in which a tree is involved. Some peculiarly organized minds have the most horrible dreams. Such dreams are reflections from their structure and state of their minds. And there are persons who live rightly and abstemiously, who also have horrible dreams. Why is this? Because they have not yet outgrown or overcome the influences from the temperaments of their ancestors. They are representatives of branches of temperamental roots, which go far back and down in the ancestral soil. They still vibrate and pulsate in the living generations. This fully accounts for the night thoughts of many who are pure and beautiful, and who think beautiful thoughts during the daytime. These same persons sometimes dream the most repulsive dreams. Ancestors predominate in their personal consciousness, and they have not willpower sufficient to keep down the rising hereditary impressions, especially during the less guarded hours of slumber. Already I have said something concerning the battle between the spirit and its circumstances, showing how all may acquire the power of conquering the unpleasant inheritance from their ancestors. I have somewhat conquered the discordant temperaments of my ancestors. I do not know who they remotely were, and I am not anxious to know. I have a fair-minded, honorable father yet in this world, and I know that I had a true, and sweet, and beautiful, and saintly mother, who now resides in a celestial community. But there were certain hereditary influences and predispositions which I found absolutely in my spirit's way. Those inheritances stood sternly up in my presence sometimes when I wished most to be utterly quiet. When I would gather spiritual strength and restore my exhausted physical powers, then up would come some hereditary imp of darkness, who would propose to carry me into discordant thoughts and scenes. At such times I would dream that I was where strange, murderous-looking people were secreting themselves in dark passages, or some other equally unpleasant dreaming. It has been so with some of you. You need not claim that you have always had harmonious, splendid, and attractive dreams. Human nature is organized on identical principles. And the action of the human faculties, under a given set of circumstances, is the same. And the experiences arising from such action is the same in all structures of mind. Some men think there is essential truth in astrology. Well, I once visited an astrologer, with a desire to test the possibilities of destiny. A distinguished professor described to me the influences of the several stars. He drew my horoscope, according to the day and hour of my birth, and then went on to tell when I was sick, or when I should have been. That certain planets were my ruling stars, both for weal and for woe, and that when certain planets came into conjunction with the body of Mars, etc., that certain things would be likely to happen to me, whereupon I concluded that I would not be steered in my individual career by the stars, and I have not been. The very star that was astrologically fixed to rule my private destiny I forthwith put out of my house. I would not have a star intercepting the orbit of my individuality. Therefore the events that astrologically were to happen to me, have not occurred in the slightest degree. Thus I teach you self-possession, although I believe that every great soul will best succeed by steering and steadying himself by the stars. Keep down the disagreeable which you have received from your ancestors. Prune away among your roots and branches. Expel old discords from your minds, and you will then have the satisfaction of knowing that your dreams are at least your own. And from this starting point you can go right onward to solid facts in your mental operations. What is important to the speedy accomplishment of this result? First of all, physiology, correct habits of eating, drinking, working, and resting. If you eat this, that, and the other thing, it will, to some extent, appear in your nervous force. Wrong conditions in your nervovital energies will induce your faculties to produce unpleasant dreams. As soon as you know what is obstructional, you can and ought to remove it. My investigations are all between 6 o'clock in the morning and 12 o'clock of the day. At night I do not dream. I sleep then. If there are any persons present, who, as witnesses, heard the lectures given in Nature's Divine Revelations, they will remember that though 3 or 4 days might have intervened between 2 discourses, yet sometimes the first words would finish a sentence which perhaps was left incomplete at the end of the previous lecture, and the thought would be thus fully expressed, showing that the spirit keeps no account of time, but takes cognizance only of events, feelings, thoughts, ideas, and principles. Many have seen the places and the scenes which I have been describing. I hear mediums mention spiritual things and describe scenery, and I recognize them as things and scenes which I have seen. If a man tells you that he saw Central Park, and that he entered at a certain gate, which he truthfully describes, then you say, "That is true, for I have seen it myself." In like manner I have it convincing testimony that other have seen the summer land. Oloenia is the name of the island which was ages ago dedicated to those Greeks who steadfastly believe in many gods, the polytheists. Oloenia is still devoted to poetry, rhetoric, history, the ode, and to music. The winding, dancing, silvery river, which flows around this island, is named Silmiral, meaning a hymn, or an anthem. It sings songs like pine trees. In certain seasons, or under the influence of certain breezes, it gives off hymnal melody, rich, varied harmonies, and aeolian, mournful symphonies. Myriads of songbirds live and sing in that region. Other birds live and sing on earth when the warm days of spring come, or mountain and plain the birds, of highest beauty, by thousands enter into the aeolian symphonies and mournful melodies of the beautiful Silmiral. Vivium is the name of a golden, fountainous spring, on the island of Oloenia. I have seen it many times. You will see it in some of your spiritual dreams. Put down the errors in the temperaments inherited from your ancestors. Become natural, and substantial, and wholly yourself. You cannot enter the superior state by any way less straight. Become healthy in your inmost, then you will see the summerland in visions of the night. You read in your religious book about the dayspring from on high, and you think it is a beautiful figure of speech. But I find that there is something corresponding to it in the fields and islands surrounding the house with many mansions. Suppose I should say that innocence is represented by a lamb. Now you read about the Lamb of God, but is there not also an animal known as a lamb? And in like manner may not the fountainous vivium, the dayspring on high, be something more than a mere figure of speech? Has not every figurative expression a corresponding literal side? The scenes of the second sphere are reflected upon the human mind whenever it is accessible and impressible. It is accomplished either by our own clairvoyant powers to rise into sight and sympathy with them, or else by the artistic pencillings upon our faculties by those who are our invisible guardians. They either do it for us, or else they kindly clear the celestial way, so that our own impressibility may invite and secure picture. I would now like to tell you about the Elgario, as they call the plant of sorrow. In the summerland there are melancholy characters, who seem disposed to remember and dwell upon the exceedingly hard times they experienced on the earth. They look like very badly abused people, were not appreciated before death, and are not happy. They are downcast and sad for a while, being indulgent of feelings of melancholy, like certain unfortunates in our lunatic asylums. But this wondrous celestial plant, which the botanists of that region call Elgario, is their sweet medicine and perfect antidote. The sad ones are led to it. They soon begin to inhale its fragrance. They breathe its atmosphere. They chew it a little every day. They soon know this flower is for the healing of God's heart-stricken children. They carry its petals and are influenced by them. The plant exerts a mystic charm. They make bouquets of it, and it relieves them of their earth-born mishaps and long-cherished sorrows. Is not this revelation also natural, beautiful, and simple? Your gifted guardian will bring the Elgario to you and say, "Take this, my beloved, smell of its holy breath, its odor will quickly relieve your aching heart." Why, a homeopathic physician, when treating a patient for a disease in the throat or lungs, may, perhaps, wish to administer phosphorus. He knows that the odor of phosphorus will sometimes relieve a severe stricture. Thus the higher physicians hand forth this beautiful plant to spirits depressed with earth-born errors and misfortune. They give it to their patients, and lo! Its odor heals and translates them into a healthy, happy, and comparatively superior state. Thus sometimes beautiful births take place. Births out of states of confirmed despondency. A mother, for example, in order to feed and clothe her children, has been overworked. She has literally worked herself to death for the sake of her dependent family. She at last died from excessive bodily fatigue and heartbroken weariness. She is borne away on the silvery river to the summer land, but she is still weary. This beautiful plant is brought to her, or she is conducted to the garden that is filled with it. Gradually it lifts her into her superior state. After a time she realizes somewhat of heavenly comfort, sweet and bare, and in the flow of the ensuing seasons, she begins to believe that there is a land of pure delight, where saints immortal reign, eternal day excludes the night, and pleasures banish pain. From her refreshed memory she says, "I used to sing that song, when I was a girl, in the Methodist Sunday school, and in our Bible class meetings. Then it was only words, now it is all so real." She looks about and sees her old neighborhood acquaintances and loved friends. She finds them in the Father's house, where there are many mansions. If it were not so, the seers would have told you. Next headline, Language and Life in the Summerland. Get but the truth once uttered, and 'tis like a newborn star, that drops into its place, and which ones circling in its placid round, not all the tumult of the earth can shake. The several languages called dead in this world, have certain roots which push themselves vigorously up through the memory, soils of the human mind and continue to bear fruit after death. Thus the Hebrews, Arabians, Assyrians, Chaldeans, Persians, Grecians, Romans, Celts, even the Scots and Picts, and various other smaller tribes and semi-nations, continue for a long time to speak the educational language of their earth life, and to cherish thoughts that flow through such verbiage, and often when such spirits have sought to communicate with impressible or congenial persons on the earth, they have succeeded in controlling mediums, so that the communication would be imparted in their native tongue. The celebrated Professor Buchanan, of Cincinnati, testifies that he heard in the city of Cleveland 10 years ago, an uneducated American lady discourse finely in French. And it was reported that Mr. Selder J. Finney, in the same city, and, I believe, on the same occasion, uttered a glorious poem in the Indian language, which, it was said, was perfectly well understood by an Indian who chanced to be present. I know how most people feel and think with reference to those transterrestrial questions, that after death all is different with the individual. There never was a greater mistake. You might as well suppose that Mother Nature, and God Nature, and Man Nature undergo radical transmigrations and reconstructions. Quite otherwise. There are no essential changes in the plan of ultimates. The final type of organization, remember, is the spiritual interior of man and woman. Both reason and intuition sustain the doctrine of no central change after death. The Bible says, "As a tree falleth, so it lieth." That is, an oak tree does not become a beech, a birch, or a mahogany, the moment it falls. It is an oak tree still. Even so if man's body falls, In sympathy with the chemistry and gravitation of the physical world, the spiritual man does not fall with it. Only the external casing is peeled off and rejected, while the personal inmost, who thought and spoke and acted before, goes onward, unchanged and individualized, to the summer land. It is the lesson of the naturalness of the afterlife, which the mind must fully conceive in order to realize that the other world is really a home in the heavens. Earthlings will not be orphans or strangers there. I must know and recognize my acquaintances, and they must know and recognize me, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 years from this, yea, an eternity hence, or immortality is nothing. The cessation of leading personal peculiarities and the reconstruction or abolishment of the essential traits of the individual organization. The mergement of the person at death from substantiality into a vapory, gauzy, ghostly inhabitant of the kingdom of heaven, there to dwell and sing and adore forever in the presence of the wifeless Trinity, is a supposition too absurd to occupy intelligent minds, being a conception eminently suited to the brainless cranium of old-time orthodoxy. And yet there are ministers who seem to pride themselves upon their profound ignorance on this subject, saying, it is an unlawful mystery, it is supernatural. In other things those same pulpitarians are just as sensible as fellow sinners in general. But come to this subject, and forthwith, with a slam, the gate of investigation is shut, and you are driven to the authoritarians' faith, which they invariably present as the best antidote for heart bereavements and spiritual prostrations. Now the after-existence opens before us as a continuation of individual progression. Instead of being a discrete degree, as Swedenborg describes it, it is seen to be another mansion, another story, in the same house eternal in the heavens. The heavens are not remote. The earth itself is situated and rolling noiselessly in the heavens. Do you not know that it travels from January to July about 97 millions of miles, and directly through the heavens? Else how could the earth move in its path around the sun? You see, therefore, that the earth itself is in the heavens, and, reversely, that the heavens are about the earth. We float at the rate of 64,000 miles an hour around the sun, which is not more really in the heavens. Now, I affirm that the Summerland is no more is in the heavens than is our sun or this earth on which we at present reside. The mind of man is stationed over his visceral organs, which are immersed in darkness within the physical body. But there is a constant communication kept up between all parts of his body and his sensorium. Consequently, the mental person who resides in the upper parts of the brain is omnipresent through the physical organs and sensations. In like manner, the second sphere is so situated with reference to this earth, that we, its inhabitants, float under the constant inspection of its population. This earth is analogous to a ponderous organ in the perfect and symmetrical anatomy of the stars. I think you will agree that this planet of ours may be, in general analogy, an id organ in the physiology of the sidereal system, and that the celestial brain, which is the Summerland, caps and coronates all these different planets, just as the mind of man covers and crowns the different organs within the trunk. Earthly languages, perfected, carried out to their ultimates, and simplified to a fine, beautiful orthography, become the language of the other sphere. But education still sways the mind and thoughts. Suppose your affections are wrapped up with expressions peculiar to the German language, then, on reaching the higher land, your memory, which is a spiritual organ, holds not the English language, nor have you attachments for any other save that in which you were primarily educated. So true is this, that persons who had been in the habit of using profane language, as it is called, and themselves over-accustomed to expressing their thoughts and emotions through those worthless viaducts and conveyances, and such habits become serious impediments and obstructions to progress, just as in this world when the coarse, vulgar word speakers would enter refined society, they meet embarrassment because they cannot use profane language with their customary freedom. If they use it constantly among ignorant men, they find themselves, when among educated persons, in a state of nervous trepidation lest the next moment they may stumble into the use of an oath. When thrown a little off their balance, they will involuntarily show that they are accustomed to very improper and very disagreeable words. This you know is true in this world. Now look into the Summerland, and you will find that the memory of many is checked when they come into the presence of finer and more educated organizations. There is a tendency, even after death, to indulge in those mental habits in which the individual has been most strongly educated. Thus, the first form of speech is that which the person most used on earth. A friend, who recently died in the Union Army, took the first opportunity to make himself manifest, and expressed his thoughts in the peculiar language which he had been accustomed to use all the years before he went. Although he was situated in finer circumstances, and influenced by the example of finer associates, still his thoughts flowed along in their accustomed channels of conversation. His thoughts were finer and higher, but they came down through the old verbiage. The second language used in the higher world is the language of music. The spirit of this language is separated from the educational tendencies of the different races. The language of music is employed in the teaching of what we call science. The truths of science, the beauties of science, and very high and glorious lessons in celestial principles, are communicated by means of symphonies, melodies, songs, hymns, anthems, and chants. Hence the impression that heaven is a place of eternal song. This wondrous music fills the whole heavens and awakens echoes among the distant planets, so that, when the stars are touched and summoned to enter the orchestra and make the magnificent chorus full, then the very earth itself seems to vibrate responsively to that grand harmonious beat, which converts the universe into a harp of infinite perfection. The third language used in the higher world is what we here call the language of the heart. It is, more properly speaking, the language of emanation. Every private affection throws out an atmosphere. Whatever your predominating love may be, it emits an atmosphere which winds itself about your person. And when the temperament is fine, sensitive, and susceptible, the odor and influence will correspond. If the individual is the victim of an inverted love, a love turned out of its pure, native channel, he throws out upon you a coarse, vicious atmosphere, which in these days is called a magnetic influence. Mediums, sensitives, and clairvoyants see it, and many persons not so gifted, feel it, and they know not whence or why. That person gives off a peculiar influence. You say, "I feel it." It depresses you, or it makes you angry. Another person makes you feel cheerful and happy and joyous, and you are physically quieted or spiritually aroused by mere contact with these more exalted characters. In the Summerland, this language of the heart is carried to an inconceivable degree of perfection. For instance, suppose you and your brother, or you and your sister, should meet, you who have not met for long, lonely years. If you have outgrown the necessity of external speech, and if you have been taught through the mysterious suggestiveness of pure music, you then deepen into the language of impersonal and perfect love. In the higher spheres, such language is alone the medium of communication. It is the language of absolute contact of personal love atmospheres, by which is meant that two persons, meeting face to face, meet also heart to heart, and are forever friends. On earth it is but the bands, or eyes, or lips, that touch and speak. There, it is the indescribably sweet and perfect meeting of soul with soul. They thus inhale and thoroughly understand each other. For the first time there sweeps through the gladdened heart the eminent satisfaction of receiving perfect appreciation through the deathless wisdom of a brother, a sister, or a companion. Your most secret history is wordlessly told and forever known. The details of your earth life appreciated, and with all their innumerable bearings upon the shape of your character, and so, too, are comprehended all the steps that have brought you to that position in the upper existence, so that the communion which takes place at that time extends through all the years, days, hours, events, and moments of your terrestrial pilgrimage. The delightfulness of this conjunction constitutes the beautiful, glorious happiness which diversifies, gladdens and exalts the inhabitants of the spheres.